Welcome to Foul Players Radio, your podcast for arts, entertainment, and pop culture. My name is Michael Spedden, your host. Every episode features interesting people with fun, fascinating stories about their journeys in the performing arts. Authors, actors, dancers, writers, musicians, athletes, comics, you name it. Folks who are center stage, backstage, on camera, or behind the scenes. Sit back and listen. Let's have some fun. Foul Players Radio is a production of the Foul Players Group and a proud member of the SJ Network. And welcome again to the Rising from the Ashes season of Foul Players Radio. My name is Michael Spedden. Today's guest is veteran rock band from Warrenton, Virginia, August. August was founded by John Piette in 1978. Their current lineup is John Piette on guitars and vocals, Jerry Bozick on drums, and Kevin Schmidt on bass. We had a great conversation with them. We discussed legendary Washington, D.C. area clubs such as Crazy Horse, the Bayou, and the Wax Museum, performing with Kix, Steppenwolf, Foghat, the Cars, Night Ranger, Johnny Van Zant, the B-52s, and Frank Martino, touring, waiting out COVID, legendary Maryland and D.C. area music stores, and marketing material in Europe. Their websites are www.augustrockband.com, www.augustmusicgroup.com, and their studio is www.dreamtracksstudio.com. DreamTracks is spelled DreamTraxx Studio, studio.com. You can also find more information on the material on Facebook, Reverb Nation, and YouTube. Subscribe for free to Foul Players Radio at www.foulplayersradio.com or listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, Deezer, Listen Notes, Player FM, Podcast Index, Overcast, Castro, CastBox, or PodFriend. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Foul Players of Perryville are now booking murder mystery shows for the late summer and fall of 2021. Indoor or outdoor venues, trains, boats, office parties, fundraisers, or just for the heck of it. You can reach us by email at foulplayersperryville@yahoo.com. You can call us at 443-600-0446. And you can also find our website at www.foulplayersofperryville.com. We'll be back with August right after these words.
Howdy, it's Matt Gwynn here, popping in to let you know about the adventures of the albino rhino. It's a show Frank the Giraffe here, my co-host James Godwin, and myself put on for you guys twice a week. Every Wednesday, we talk to a comedian, and every Friday, we call it Freak Yeah Friday. The show itself is not safe for work, and that freak is definitely a different word. I just don't know what podcast you're going to be listening to this promo on. And I don't want to, start screaming explicatives while you're sitting in your office. If you're lucky enough to have been able to go back to the work that you did before inside of an office or whatever, you know. But we go on an adventure twice a week, and it's a good time because we get to sit down and talk to some really cool people. And I enjoy it because, you know, I'm just curious little albino who likes to get to know folks, you know. You can find us a couple ways, actually multiple ways, really. Man, there's a lot of different ways to find us. You can find us through our central hub, which is www.albinorhino.me. It's the website. Find me on. And then, you know, the podcast, you can find the videos on YouTube. Search for Adventures of the Albino Rhino. Also linkable from our website. And you can also find us through Anchor, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Radio Public, and Spotify. That's right. We're on the same place Joe Rogan is. Granted, we're not the Joe Rogan Experience, but you know what I mean? We're there. So give us a listen. Promise you won't be dissatisfied. And enjoy your day.
is going on, minions? Mike here for Misery Point Radio, and you're listening to the Coast to Coast Power Hour on the SJ Network. Now, I know what you're thinking. Mike, what the F is a Coast to Coast Power Hour? Well, my uneducated and uninformed friend, the Coast to Coast Power Hour is a Borg-like collective of epic podcasters from epic podcasts that have all come together to discuss the important things in life. Pop culture, current events, random awesomeness, stuff like that. Trust me, you need this in your life. For more information on this show and all the shows on the Coast to Coast Power Hour, as well as on the SJ Network, reach out to publicist Steve Joyner at www.s-j-network.com or stevesjnetwork@gmail.com. No need to thank me. I'm just out here, you know, changing lives.
What's Your Effin' Binge is a podcast brought to you by Chris, Anchor, and Spotify. And what we talk to our guest about is what they're currently binge-watching on TV. And what we do is we like to take a different approach. I don't want to know what the name of the show is that they're going to talk about before they come on. I have to actually guess it. So I ask them who, what, when, where, why, and try to figure out what it is that they're watching. A lot of times I'm able to guess it, and sometimes I'm not. And that's fine. That adds to the comedy of the show. We like to bring our guest on, whether they're a model or an actress or a producer or musician, and just let them have a platform to be able to tell everybody what they have coming up next, and also entertain everybody with what's worth watching. So I hope everybody tunes in for the next episode of What's Your Effin' Binge. Thanks. It's Chris.
So we'd like to welcome August to Foul Players Radio. Guys, you've been playing in this area for a really long time. You've had a lot of great stories to tell us today. And, you know, you've been in the clubs and recording and performing for all this time. We have John Piette, we have Jerry Bozek, and we have Kevin Schmidt. So welcome, fellas. It's good to have you today.
Thank you, Mike. Really good to be here, too.
Right. So you're definitely veterans of this scene and, you know, playing not only in this area, but, you know, all over the place, really. So tell us, when did this begin?
1978. I went in the studio to do a 3-song cassette, ended up with a 45 record, got talked up. And we started sending the record out to promoters like Cellar Door and them, and got a phone call from them saying, who are you? No one sends records. So we made a mistake, turned into something good. So then I put out an LP. And at the time, I used different people, a couple of guys from Muscle Shoals and a couple of local guys. And it did so well that I put together a band. Jerry Bozek was there in 1978. Mm-hmm. And we went out and started supporting it. As Richard Harrington of the Washington Post wrote one time, he goes, Lord knows any band that can play all originals and still do well in the clubs is a feat in itself. We came out of nowhere playing all originals. That shook everybody up. You can't do that. And we did. You know, we added some stuff as we went on, but we came out as an original act. In those days, it was pretty tough. We started cutting our teeth as Louis Rock City. We played like every Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And basically just to get our licks in and stuff. And then we did a lot of shows for them. But back in those days, you had to have 48,000 watts of lights, gigantic sound, follow spots. It was the real deal. And to get in places like we played the Bayou, which is the classic place, that was mm-hmm. 6 sets a night. Dave Williams, one of the heads, he said, play your first set over again at 3 a.m. No one will notice because 6 sets is a long night.
That's a long night.
At the time, we had a singer with us from Cherry Smash, Doug Allen, who Cherry Smash was real big in D.C. before us. And so that got us into the Crazy Horse. Jack and Dave from the Cell Door allowed us to play both their club and the Crazy Horse, which is good. So we were regulars at the Bayou. And the whole time is just getting our experience in. And then we got to do Mike Schreiman, who had Concerts America. He's sort of been my mentor all through it. He got us into Wax Museum with Frank Marino, and that's where Atlantic Records came down and offered me the first deal. And so we were very fortunate to play because you had to be good in those days or they wouldn't bring you back. You had to sell tickets. And you're talking about 6 sets. We pretty much had to buy you like 6 nights straight. And it wouldn't tell the liquor law chains that whole concept of making really good money. A lot of the bars started going 6 bands instead of 6 sets. And I used to run a nightclub. And this is my philosophy. If you have to call to ask who's playing, you already lost that person. Back in the 70s, 80s, you had to be good. So people just showed up, you know. Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, I agree that with
One thing that I found, because my heyday of playing was in the 80s and early 90s. Mm-hmm. One thing that the point that you said, you had to be good to sell tickets. Nowadays, being good and selling tickets aren't always the same thing. Some bands are good. Some bands sell tickets, but they're not always both.
Correct.
And that's something that I saw quite a bit of. And that was a problem that we had sometimes, too. When it comes to getting cheeks in the seats, as they would say, when a national act would come through, you could have been well suited with your material and of the same playing quality and would have been a great show with them. But if somebody, and they weren't always as good, would come along, but they could bring, 200 people with them or whatnot. Guess who got that show?
Yeah. Well, see, we were fortunate. We had a good following. We were doing Maryland, Virginia, Delaware, West Virginia. So we had a good following. So we got on shows like when the Kicks came out at Cumberland Fairgrounds. Mm-hmm. They stuck us on that because we had a good following there too. Atlantic Records gave us credits for a lot of ticket sales up there, and that was 20,000 people. We got shows like at the Wax Center. Frank Marino did Steppenwolf a couple times, and John Kay was very nice to us. He always made sure we had plenty of room on stage, which, a lot of national acts don't care. But we got to do a lot of nice shows, especially working with Celador. They were the promoters. We got a call one night from Dave. He sent us down to the Much More in Richmond's 3,000 seat a hall, and we opened for Johnny Van Zandt on the opening of his tour, so Celador could help you like that. I end up working for them over at Nissan Pavilion doing the audio and operations, and they took good care of me. And then I had a great relationship with Jack and Janet and John all the way through, and he was a very big mentor in the business.
Interesting. It's cool that Steppenwolf actually gave you some room on the stage, because that was always a pet peeve of mine, because the fact that I'm a big guy and I take up a lot of room on stage anyhow, not even moving around. Mm-hmm. And especially when another local band does that to you, when they give you like 3 inches to stand and everything,
Right.
A couple of people almost put through the wall back in those days because, and plus to you being the drummer, that's got to drive you up the wall too. When they give you, 2 inches to set up and they don't share sets or whatever with you.
Yep. Well, if you remember the Crazy Horse, the band, we were set up behind the bar. Mm-hmm. We were right. The bartender's heads are right at our feet, so you had no room there, and they'd ring that bell right in front of you. Mm-hmm. And, but the one of the best experiences, I love Fog Hat, and I'm friends with Lonesome Dave's son right now. Mm-hmm. And actually we did an interview with him. He has a blog. And we did the Bayou with them. I would have played for free to be with them. Dave was like, after the show, come by the dressing room. So my guitar player and I walked by. It was crowded, and we just waved him off. He was like, no, come in. I made a comment about the big time, and he looked at me and goes, what do you mean? This is, you were in the big time. So we got treated real nice by some really big people. The worst thing I did to Steppenwolf the last time we played with him, my encore was Immigrant Song, because I had a singer that could do it. Mm-hmm. And they came to me and go, my God, he wanted to start off with the push, and now he's rewriting the set because we did an up-tempo.
Oh, and,
But, they knew I didn't do it on purpose. But we've had some good experiences with some of the big names, and some big people in the business have helped us. And it's still going on right now. I've got some good mentors. Some of them are retired, but they still will help me out because we're doing a lot of publishing, writing for other people. I own a Dream Track studio. This is my second studio. So I produce a lot of records for other people during the time. So we're just having a good time. And, we get together, we rewrite songs, we write new songs. We got a bunch of material. We just started releasing some of the publishing songs, which is some of them are country. And people like them a lot, because we're a rock band. But you explain to them this is a different company, August Music Group, and then August Rock Band. So we're having a great time with that as well.
Wonderful.
Getting close to placing something, so hopefully it'll work out.
Well, great. Now, have all three of you been in the band together this whole time?
Well, I started everything in 78. Jerry came with me in 78 for a year or two. Mm-hmm. And then I had another drummer, Donnie Spence from the Kicks. He was with us for quite a while. And then Dave Jenkins, another local guy. And then I came up the road in 99. I was a single dad of two little kids, and I raised them. And then once they got to a certain point, about 10 years ago, I was working with Trish Yearwood Band. Her guitar player, Johnny Garcia, would always say, what are you going to do with your songs? Because they had recorded in my other studio. He explained to me about publishing, which I had no clue. So that got me geared up. So I brought people together to work on that. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you know, the Atlantic Records called me one day and says, where are you playing? I go, Virginia, Maryland, DC. And he goes, that's the Mid-Atlantic. So from now on, you're touring the Mid-Atlantic. I go, okay, that's fine. After working with bands like Trish Yearwood, for guitar player Johnny Garcia kept asking me about, I have a big song catalog, over 200 songs. What are you going to do with the songs? Publishing. And then finally, he explained to me what publishing was, which I had no clue. And so about 10 years ago, I put together, I have another studio, people to record that. So I got Jerry back, because I always liked his drumming. We started doing the publishing song, and all of a sudden, August became popular again. So we ended up releasing three CDs of my rock, of August songs that have done real well around the world. And just recently, in the last 3 years, Kevin came on. He's a local guy. And the bass player I had originally is a local guy. And here we came up with Southern rock and all that kind. The bass players have a different feel. And Kevin grew up out here too, so I wanted that feel again. So Kevin came with us and been doing a great job ever since. He's already on one CD. We got two CDs in the works right now. So So that's how we are right now. And we have five-piece band, but we're down to three. And then I do bring in keyboard players and other guitar players when we need them for the studio. If we go back live again, which we hope to, we may bring one or two of those with us too, you know, even though we can do a three-piece.
Oh, yeah.
But we're wide open, just having a great time.
I love a good power trio.
Everybody says that too.
There's something to be said about a good power trio.
We just did an interview in the UK. We get a lot of airplay there. And he said the same thing. I love a power trio. He says we work harder.
We
do work harder.
so many great ones over the years too. You know, Cream, James Gang, Triumph, Rush. So many great ones from over the years. You had mentioned Muscle Shoals earlier. Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit more about that.
There was a band. I used to promote concerts, believe it or not. I used to rent the armories and stuff. And there was a band that came up here called Buckeye. And mm-hmm. Mike Smoot was the bass player. And Ray Brand was mm-hmm. the guitar player. The drummer was a local person. At the time I was promoting them in concerts, I was started working on my LP. I asked Mike Smoot, the bass player, who I'm still friends with to this day, to play on my record. And we worked out a deal. And then Ray Brand was this phenomenal slide player. And they've done a lot of work at Muscle Shoals. They're from down that way. Mm-hmm. He's from Huntsville. He came to one of the rehearsals, which really made me feel weird, because he was this phenomenal guitar player. And then at a break, Mike goes, Ray wants to talk to you. And I'm like, oh, crap. He's not going to tell me how bad I am. And he comes to me and goes, can I play on your record? I'm like, oh, my God. So he played on that record, and he had a little medicine bottle he got from Dwayne Allman's people, and mm-hmm. he would play slide. It's unbelievable. So they went back south, and I tried to find him because, you know, I got a record deal, mm-hmm. and I couldn't find him, and they thought that I wasn't interested. Mm-hmm. And so, we still end up doing good. And like I said, Ray and I had been talking. He unfortunately passed away from cancer a few years ago.
I saw that.
He was in the middle of recording two of my songs for his new Crawlers album. And actually he wanted me to come down and play on it, which I would love to. And, you know, that's just one of the poor, unfortunate things, but we're redoing that. I've re-released that record. Sells on eBay for like $200. It's ridiculous. We put out a CD just remastered, and that sold out, but it didn't stop the sales. So I'm redoing, the three of us are redoing the whole LP with the ability, talent, and the sound we got today. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing all the singing all of a sudden. We use a bunch of different singers, which were good singers. The people in the business look at me and goes, John, why don't you just sing it? Because, you know, the whole thing about publishing, you got to sell the song. You know what you're singing and believable. Mm-hmm. And it's worked out good. So I'm going to keep on singing until I can, I guess.
Wonderful.
So that's where we're at right now.
That's awesome that you got to go down there. What a storied studio. I mean, I saw the documentary on it, and mm-hmm. I didn't realize how much rock and roll history came out of there until after I saw it. It was just an amazing documentary. And of course you got to work down there and, you know, meet those folks and everything.
Well, I never went down there. They came up here.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I want to go. In the last few months, I got a contact from a guitar player who's still doing session. He and Ray used to do sessions there together. He reached out to me and we talked. I can't remember his name right now. I feel bad about that. But I definitely want to go. For a couple of years, my daughter, who's real big into music, she's 24, 25 now. We went to Memphis. We've been to Graceland. You know, we take music trips. Saw Sun recording. Muscle Shoals is a little farther than a weekend drive, but I definitely want to get there. I will get there eventually.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw that documentary, too. It's really great what they did.
Wasn't that amazing? wasn't it? They just did such a wonderful job on that. Such a great story. And yeah, I mean, I just can't say enough about it. It's just, it was just awesome. I really loved it. And it was one of those ones that you want to keep, you know, that's a keeper for your archives there. Definitely.
Well, you know, Sun Studios is the same thing. You take that tour and they have the spot where Elvis stood and it's pretty interesting. And they're still an active studio in the evening. I was surprised and went to Stax, which got torn down, but you're still in an area where all this stuff was happened at. Memphis is unbelievable, you know. We went all the way up to Cleveland to the Hall of Fame thing, which I wasn't that impressed with, but I did like the Christmas house. We went there. That's also in Cleveland. You know, so it's interesting to go back and see all those classic places. And I've been fortunate to work with a lot of people who have some great backgrounds, you know.
Oh, absolutely. The stories are just amazing. And that's part of what I'm really trying to capture with this, you know. And let me give you some perspective here as to why I'm doing this. And I've told a couple of my guests kind of, you know, offline and everything, but what folks have been able to accomplish around here, you know, you guys and, you know, some of the guests that I've had on in the past and I'm going to have back for repeats, you know, like Bud Becker promoting concerts in this area for, God, it'll be almost 55 years. I mean, he's pretty much retired now.
Right.
But he's probably got about 55 years worth of stories. And yeah, I know
I've seen his pictures on Facebook. He's got some killer pictures.
If nobody keeps these stories alive, they're going to die. They're going to die as soon as the people are gone. And you know, one of the reasons was, is that, you know, I've lost a couple of old band members over the last couple of years. I'm 52. You know, I'm kind of like on the beginning end of that. And I'm sure
you're the young guy.
Yeah. But I've had a couple of once you hit 50, that's almost like a weeding out point for some people, unfortunately. You know, I had a couple of friends and old band members that we lost right around this age group. And I was doing an open mic about 15 years ago. And I'm not going to mention the person, not to embarrass them. But it was a fellow who was in a very well-known band in this region. You know, one of the ones that was just like, you know, the Rolling Stones, or they may have been like the Rolling Stones around here. Playing an acoustic open mic and a bunch of young kids, and it's not their fault. They didn't know. So we were there waiting to play, and you know, he was there, and my bandmate knew him and talked to him a little bit. And then I heard one of the kids that was hosting it say to one of his friends, okay, you can go on after that old guy over there. And I was like, I was like, well, wait, he doesn't know. He doesn't know. I felt like saying, do you know who that is?
Yeah.
Do you know who that is? That guy was like the Rolling Stones around here. He is part of this area's history. It's not some old guy. I mean, I know you don't know any better, but so I thought that these stories really needed to be told and preserved, you know, and shared with folks, you know, and then even, you know, and also to, you know, have folks who witnessed and were around during this bring back some good memories as well. So, and I want to thank you guys for being with us today. I mean, there's plenty of more that I'd like to talk about with you here. Definitely. But I'm glad that you all and a number of other folks have come forward. And I've been reunited with quite a few people I knew back in those days, too, that I hadn't spoken to or seen in 30 years. So I hope this really, you know, continues to do good around here. People continue to enjoy it. I mean, since I guess you saw that I put something up on the DC rock scene from 80s and 90s page on Facebook, I think that's where we met. And I mean, people have just been instant messaging me on Facebook, you know, just the kindest things because they've really enjoyed what we've done so far. And I continue.
That's what caught my eye too. I appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah, well, thank you. So Jerry, you know, you have been with this guy for a while now, on and off, it looks like, and you're working with him now. So tell us a little bit about your story, you know, with August and maybe some of the other things you've done over the years.
Well, I'm from Maryland originally. I was friends with a lot of the people that owned Venomin Music in Rockville.
Sure.
I was up there every day and making friends with everybody, meeting a lot of people. And all of a sudden, John Piette calls me and tells me that Ted Veneman suggested that he call me about being his drummer. And it's been history ever since. So we got together and we toured and played the local areas. And
Ted sort of adopted August. He liked us a lot.
Yes.
And he did a lot of favors over the years, and I really miss having them around. And he's the one who came to me, and I was like, we had auditioned we had a drummer working with us, and like 2 weeks before we were supposed to play, he's, because his religious background, he had to go on a sabbatical for like 2 years. We're like, what? So I was telling Ted about it, and he says, I got somebody for you. And then that's how we met Jared.
Oh.
But Ted was very influential in helping us, you know, supporting us in the early days.
Mm-hmm. That was quite a music store too, Venomans. I'd been there a couple of times. I'm from around Baltimore, so I didn't get down there that much, but you know, there were some great ones up near us too. You know, Gordon Miller's, you know, Bill's Music House is still there. Gordon Miller, Dundalk Music was, you know, a smaller store, but they had some great stuff there too. And I always enjoyed going to the local stores first. You know, whenever I needed something, I'd always go and see if they had it first before I'd go to a chain. You know, like Guitar Center's a fine store too, but you know what I, you know, kind of mean. You know, there was a Venomans, and Chuck Levins was out near that area.
Used to, Rolls Music was a big one. Phil over Rolls Music did a lot of deals for me. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's funny. I was, when we first started touring, I was very loud on stage. They turned me backwards, covered me up. So I said something to Ted one day, and he goes, go downstairs. My guitar tech is John Warden. He makes guitars for Rush and blah, blah, blah. To this day, John is still my guy. He lives way up in Maryland. We'll make that trip. But the work he did on my guitars are still the same work. It's never broke down on me. And the guy, John, is just phenomenal. So Ted also helped me that way as well, you know.
Awesome. And,
yeah, Rolls was real good in the early days too. You could get any guitar for $225 back in those days. Les Paul, Strats, you know. And so, yeah, you know, then when I took over at Nissan, when tours needed things, I would call both of them, and they really appreciate that. You know, they, somebody, whether they needed sticks or whatever, speakers. So, you know, we always try to support. To this day, we still support local businesses, you know, of all kinds, but especially in the music one as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, you know, Jaeger's was another one that comes to mind in East Baltimore, if you remember that. Something great about these old music stores, you know, just, you know, the memories of going in there, taking lessons, and you know, so many people you'd meet, you know, just like Jerry, you know, you're saying you would go in there to make friends. It was the Facebook back then. If you weren't in a club, you could go to a music store and meet people and make friends. Definitely.
Exactly.
So
you're Frank Marino too.
Yeah, I became friends with Frank Marino from Mahogany Rush. And we used to go party with him after his shows, my wife and I. I've been married since I was in high school.
Oh, okay. Okay. Wow.
Oh my God. Yep, and then we got to do, we did actually the showcase for Atlantic Records at the Waxers, and we opened for Frank.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, right. Frank locked us in the dressing room, and so we're in the dressing room with two guys from Atlantic Records, and Aziz is Ahmed Erdogan, the owner's nephew, and he's like, "Who is that guy? Why did he lock us in?" And I go, "Oh, that's Frank Marino." It was we actually did two shows with him, but you know, that was kind of the way things went back in those days sometimes.
Sure. And Kevin, so you are pretty much the new boy here, huh?
Yes, indeed.
But he's known us. We grew up together.
Yeah.
So we've known each other for years and years.
Oh, sure. So tell us, who have you played with, you know, I'm guessing the past, you know, prior to August?
Well, I've played in mostly all just local bands. My brother, Charles, was a guitar player. Well, he was a drummer and then a guitar player. So I played in a lot of local bands around the area, cover bands, bars, and my favorite, field parties. And, you know,
that was big out here. We all did that, man.
Yeah. Funny story. I was playing saxophone in the school band. And my brother came in and popped two strings off a hollow body and said, "I need a bass player for the Battle of the Bands." He showed me how to do an A walk, and there you go. I was on the way. And the band turned out to be this band named Jonathan Wildpig that John played drums for at one time, I believe.
Way back.
I mean, I was like 13 then. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Then I went to Maryland and kind of did the same thing. You know, we would play in cover songs. If everybody knew the same songs, you could throw something together for a weekend, you know, somebody's having a party or something. And it was a blast.
Right. Yeah. We all have those standards out there that everybody sort of seems to know. And you can always, you know, pull an impromptu, at least, you know, usually almost up to a set out of those, you know, with.
See, Warrington's out here in the country, mm-hmm. so field parties were a big thing. Yeah, yeah. The mm-hmm. last time we did a show, according to the Prince William County Police Department, there was 3,000 people at the show. And but so that was how we grew up. But we out here was all music. Everybody played music, different styles. We had some great funk bands I worked with, mm-hmm. and we all worked together. You know, and it's still a good community out here that way with the original local people. Mm-hmm. We all get along great, and the music has always been good out here. You know, and we're very fortunate now, you know, mm-hmm. and that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. There's there and the, I was more Baltimore oriented, but I did come down and play DC from time to time as well. And right. with us being more, I was in a hair band at first, you know, one of those like a Guns N' Roses type of thing. And then uh-huh. after that, we got kind of into more of an alternative. I guess we were kind of more like the Cult, the Cure, Bowie, Bauhaus, that kind of a sound.
Yep, I love that.
Yeah, the darker end of it. Mm-hmm. And I felt like we almost went over better playing in DC because mm-hmm. Of the originality down there. There right. seemed to be DC bands, and I'm sure maybe you've observed this too. We're not afraid to go out on a limb
right,
and do something a little more original and march to the beat of their own drummer and be themselves.
Yep.
Baltimore, you know, and again, you know, the band sounded good. They looked good. Everybody, you know, good players, you know, they weren't, you know, they weren't bad bands at all, but it seemed like, you know, up in Baltimore, they wouldn't know originality if it smacked them in the face with a frying pan, you know?
I don't know. But I will say this, when you brought in Hammerjacks, in mm-hmm. that era, there was a place called Coast to Coast. Do you remember that in Baltimore? It used to be a giant food. It was humongous. Mm-hmm. The difference was, according to our manager, we could play Hammerjacks for free, mm-hmm. or we can go to Coast to Coast and get our normal fee, which is, you know, and place was gigantic. We had it. So we did that, you know, because we were making money, mm-hmm. you know. And so it would been nice to play Hammerjacks. But, that, you know, a lot of clubs were like that in those eras. It's a privilege to play here, you know, the first time, you know. Mm-hmm. And but we went to Coast to Coast. We did a lot. If you look at our list, Southern Maryland, it seemed like every pier had a bar on it yeah. somewhere. yeah. And we played it. Oh, there was a place called Fisherman's Inn. Mm-hmm. And that guy was great to us. And it was just packed, you know. Mm-hmm. And we had a great time playing in Maryland. People mm-hmm. consider us a Virginia band. Jerry is from Maryland. That's mm-hmm. what I always tell them. But we spent most of our time. If we leave here in Warrington and go to Winchester, Virginia, mm-hmm. to get to 81 circuit, take 90 days to do one circuit. And mm-hmm. we would end up in Ocean City, then back to the Bayou. You know what I mean? So we would 81 circuit up through Hagerstown, Cumberland, Ridgely, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, D.C., you know, Baltimore and all those places over Dundalk, you know, I couldn't even tell you. So, you know, it was a great 90 days. You just make a pass and then you'd start over again, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and it was great. But people came out in those days. So there were some times when economy was rough. I remember playing some places in the Midwest where they had nickel beer because people had no jobs. The biggest right. employer was the military. Mm-hmm. And so they would just to get people in the bars, they would have nickel beer, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember Iron City House Beer, something out of Pennsylvania, was like the nickel beer.
But as it should have been.
But people showed up. You know, that's the difference now. You know, we did do a show here in Warrington a couple of years ago, and we sold out. There was like 300 seats. It wasn't a bar. It was a hall. Mm-hmm. That, you know, had no booze and stuff, so you couldn't smoke in there. So people just came to see us, which made us feel really good. And we had some other dates that got canceled because of the virus thing. So we're hoping things open back up, you know, within reason. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's where we're at on that. But we do have two, possibly three CDs in the works to come out in the next year or so.
Yep. You know, that's interesting that you say that, because I really think after quarantine, I think we're going to have another renaissance in this country mm-hmm. as far as everything coming out. They have found a way to do some TV shows and movies to remain COVID compliant.
Right.
As far as, you know, being able to get it and make sure that they're not, you know, becoming a hotbed of COVID during this time. But I think, I mean, there's been a lot of people writing. There's been a lot of people recording. There's been a lot of people, you know, preparing plays and preparing lots of other productions. And I really think, you know, once the masks go away, once the social distancing is over, that people, not only the creative people putting out product, but I think the people in the audience are going to want to get out. Mm-hmm. And these places are just going to be packed. And I don't think there's going to be enough as performers we can do to satisfy the demand, you know, because it's right. really going to be big. And I'm looking forward to those days because, I play a little bit. I'm in an acoustic duo. Mm-hmm. And we probably get out about, about 5 or 10 times a year. But we're not something, we're more of a specialty novelty act. We don't go somewhere and play the whole night.
Right.
But I do have, I'm primarily now an actor, and I've got a murder mystery company that performs on boats and trains and in vineyards and breweries, and we do our shows there. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, people are dying to get back out, dying to perform, and dying to go see shows.
Right.
So I think we're all going to be very, very busy. The social distancing and the masks go away. Mm-hmm. Be like a floodgate opening up.
Yeah, hopefully so. I know a lot of the acoustic acts around here, they've been playing like at the wineries. I know, say, everybody does it early. It's like 4 to 7, which is not bad. It's better than, what it used to be. But but there's a couple of bars that have bands in them, I had my studio open back in June for one special client. We shut down when it happened, but he kept asking me. And then I got sick. I got COVID. And that was 20 days craziness in my life and my girlfriend and my son. Mm-hmm. And we all survived it. And then I still haven't really opened the studio. We're in the studio because, the three of us. But we're very careful. And I got the antibodies. But I actually got my first shot because I work a federal job where I'm exposed every day. I've never missed one day. We've stayed open the whole time. Hopefully with the vaccine stuff, I got a couple of clients that had a project a year ago stuck right in the middle. And I was like, hopefully once I get my second shot, I feel safe enough to open up for you guys. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I did every precaution in the world and still got sick. And, so many people haven't done well. I'm very fortunate to have done well. I don't want to do it twice. Let me tell you that much. So that's the scary part.
Yeah, I know a couple of people that have died from it. I know a couple of people that it has really knocked them for a loop, right. And it was really scary for them. I've been fortunate, with my day job, I've been able to work from the house, and I really haven't gone out much at all. And I've just really been podcasting like this, instead of, normally I would have making the drive down to visit you guys and do an interview that way, but I've been doing it kind of like this this past year, I've got my first shot and I'm due for my second shot in a few days. So hopefully that'll help, I guess the more of us that are getting the shots and everything, the sooner we're going to be able to get back to normal. And I'm just, like I said, I just can't wait till those times come, because performers need to perform.
We're anxious to perform too. That's not what was our original goal, but we've done like five shows. And if there's concerts, we don't do clubs. So if you want an hour and a half show, an hour show, but we had such a good time and people were receptive of it. And, we've had comments, people going, you're still doing this after all these years. They think it's great, but that's all that's what I feel I want to do every day. Like I said, I'm fortunate I go downstairs and I got a recording studio, world-class studio pretty much. And we just keep writing and tracking this whole time, And, after we get done with you, we're getting ready to shoot another video.
Oh, that's great.
That I think one of the big guys over in the UK picked out, went through my whole catalog, he picked this song. Mm-hmm. We've had some good offers, but either they're not 100%, they're not exactly 100%. Mm-hmm. What we want, that there's some catches. Mm-hmm. And we're not desperate, but we're working it. And so we're doing videos and got new songs. And I did bring my keyboard player in. If they feel comfortable, I feel comfortable, then we'll bring them in to the track, but as for being open, I'm still being hesitant a little bit on that,
understood.
And it's hard. I've talked to a lot of people, professional, military, high up, get their opinions of what's really true. You hear so much stuff. And they's like, even though you have the antibodies, you should get the shot. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I'll get the shot. The first shot got me sick because my antibodies in my body thought it was the real virus. Mm. They forgot to tell me that. So after 48 hours of 101, I feel great, you know. So if that's what I have to do, that's fine with me, you know. So, but anyway, so, you know, we're waiting to see what happens with that. It's scary and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So in the past, you had mentioned a couple of national acts that you had played with. Who are some other folks that you've performed with over the years?
Actually, I'll tell you the weird ones that we did B-52s.
Okay.
They had to do a tour for their Rock Lobsters. Remember that Rock Lobster song?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They were required to go around to all the cities and hold a Rock Lobster contest. So they came to us and they go, can we play first and we can get the hell out of town? We're like, sure. So they opened for us. But Cars, Night Ranger, Frank Marino, Fog Hat, mm-hmm. Frank Marino, Johnny Van Zant.
You mentioned Steppenwolf.
And then years ago at Louis, there was a band called Off Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had amps on stage with lights in them, no speakers. And then years later, when I worked with Cheap Trick, guess what was on stage? Those same cabinets with lights. So no one's ever answered. Was Off Broadway really Cheap Trick before they became Cheap Trick? But mm-hmm. We opened for them. Remember that? Okay. They just had these, yeah. And his speaker cabinets is a par. There's a light, there's no speaker in it, and he's not hiding it. But I swear, when they were at Nissan, I looked on stage and I go, that's the same cabinets I saw with Off Broadway. So, mm-hmm. Anyway, so stuff like that, you know. But we did multiple dates with a lot of those. So, you know,
there was that was a big Marshall amp, and I'm sure others did it, a big marketing gimmick where these bands would just have these stacks and stacks of Marshall speaker cabinets mm-hmm. on stage. Most of them were dummy cabinets. They were hollow. Yep. They were just, as a matter of fact, I saw Cheap Trick. Boy, I mean, I'm like a piece of furniture at a Cheap Trick show because I've seen them so many times.
Yeah.
I saw them at Hammer Jacks, and I was up, you know, how you could like be in the back and like really look down on the stage mm-hmm. there. Like I could look behind, you know, Rick Nielsen. I could see behind the dummy Marshall cabinets or whatever cabinets they had. I think they had like speaker cabinets that were dummy, but they were like black and white checker because that's like a big theme with Cheap Trick.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I looked down.
Probably had a light in there too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I looked down and I could see behind all those, he just had like, you know, this Fender, like a twin reverb amp mm-hmm. back there that he had mic'd. And, you know, of course, he had 40,000 guitars with him. You know, he always right. does that. I think he plays a different guitar every song, which is entertaining. And but God bless him. You know, they're still at it after all these years and mm-hmm. still out there touring. And, you know, they've brought a couple of additional musicians with them. I think right. Xander's son has been playing with him and Rick Nielsen's son is now the drummer.
Yep.
Right.
But I tell you, they still sound great.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I'll tell you a couple of shocking things. You know, when I wasn't on tour, I worked at from the Capitol Center to the Union and Warner Theater and stuff. And the Patriot Center, I was sound engineer there, to the Cult, my yeah. favorite band. They're on stage. So we get them set up. They're doing a sound check. I walk up on stage and behind the Marshall is a Galion Krueger twin that he was playing through.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Talk about disappointed, but it sounded great. Mm-hmm. And then at the Capitol Center, we did Judas Priest. And we're up on stage after the show, and this girl reaches for one of the Marshall's heads, double stack up. I go, I'll help you. She goes, oh, they're empty. It's just a 9-volt battery with the light. They were all 9. They come from Manny's, used to rent the empty stuff.
Oh, okay.
With the Marshall head with the light on, and it's a 9-volt battery made the lights come on. So, but the Galion Krueger always got me. I'm like, man, I love the Cult sound, but I can't mm-hmm. believe that's a Galion Krueger.
Wow. Now we're, I saw the Cult. Let me see. I saw them at Meriwether with Billy Idol. Mm-hmm. And I saw them at the Capitol Center with Metallica. Was mm-hmm. that one of the shows that you're talking about?
Or it was the one with well, he still had Matt Sorum as a drummer. That's before Guns N' Roses took him.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know,
yep.
So it was that one Soul Sister was his tour, I think, where he had that song. And mm-hmm. I don't know what, I got the CD, but he
Sonic
was,
Temple.
Hey, he headlined the Patriot Center. That's 10,000 seats. So mm-hmm. he was doing good at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That guy's phenomenal. I'd love to have seen him with the Doors. You know, yes. Maybe he did a couple of Doors dates.
He did. They did the Doors. I think they had to name it something differently because of rights or something like that. But
something
it was
happened.
All...
Yeah, because they got to Jones Beach in New York, and then it stopped.
Right.
But they said he was phenomenal singing Jim Morrison.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they're both in the same range. I mean, yeah. they both had, like, the same singing ranges and everything. And, yeah, I saw them on, gosh, one of the late night shows. May have been Jay Leno. And it was the surviving members of the Doors and Ian Astbury, and it was just phenomenal. I mean, he really did a nice job with that.
Yeah.
He, even cut his hair to look like him and everything, and he wore the outfits. And yeah, and that was well done. Yeah. That was well done. It was one of those ones. Sometimes they wonder if they can bring somebody else in and pull it off, but in that case, I really think they did.
Singers are hard. You know, one of my favorite bands was Foreigner. Mm-hmm. And I worked with them several times. And actually, usually I don't bother them, but I talked to Lou Graham. He was with them. You know, this is after all the problems. And I really do have a lot of respect for them. And Atlantic love my stuff. Mm-hmm. They wanted me to let them have two of my songs for their last record. I didn't understand publishing at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I lost a lot of money on that deal. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'd love... it's hard to replace singers. The guy they got now is okay. But, you know, Lou is Lou. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It's hard to replace a singer.
It sure is. Because that's, you know, pretty much the personality of the band.
Right.
Unless it's really done early on. But it's hard, mm-hmm. like once the band is really established and they're known and they have a lot of songs and well-known albums out there, it's kind of difficult to have somebody come in and fill those shoes.
Yeah. That did the same with Journey with the second Steve. He was good, but, you know, it's not Steve Perry. And the guy right now, I give him credit. Mm-hmm. You know, the Filipino guy is really good, but still not the original guy. You know, it's kind of hard to replace because he was sort of I saw them years ago when it was instrumental. Mm-hmm. They were at the Capstone, and I think Neil and them came from Santana or something like that.
They did, and, yeah.
The record company says, if you don't get a singer, you're gone. So they brought Steve Perry in. Mm-hmm. And I think it just turned it. I remember we were on tour, and I was like, who in the heck is this guy? You know, they kept playing this stuff for me. It's like, you know, I'm glad I'm not the singer in my band, but you know, the guy was phenomenal. And even though they weren't heavy rock, they came right into the heavy rock circuit. All those people loved Journey.
Mm-hmm. You know? They sure did. They sure did. It was Greg Raleigh came from Santana too. He was the keyboard player, and he did a lot of the vocals early on when they had vocals.
Right.
There was a couple of songs where he and Steve Perry would kind of trade back and forth that are really good songs too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was good stuff back in those days, huh?
Yeah. You know, and I've seen and heard them since. It's hard to, mm-hmm. that range is hard. I mean, you get older.
Yeah.
You know, yep. They just can't really do it. It's not that bad, but I caught myself on the last Steve Perry expecting to hear that high note, but he never went there. You know what I mean? But it sounded good, but you knew he could do that real high note before. Like the original singer I had, he had a 5-octave range. And I remember the rec company going, you're starting in 4. Where are you going to go? Start at 2, you know, work your way up. But, you know, if you got it in those days, you used it, you know?
Yeah. Back in those days too, it's something that you don't see anymore is, people had such command over their instruments back in those days too. You know, now back in those days, people really played their instruments. Nowadays, it seems like, you know, with a lot of people, the instruments playing them, or they just haven't quite cracked that really.
Right. We still play ours.
Oh yeah.
I said back then, you know what I'm talking about, but you had to be good in those days. You couldn't pull off, but you had to have great equipment. Mm-hmm. And, it was required, you know, 48 parts. You know, we had a lighting guy that would hang trusses every, no matter how small, it could be a small bar. That'd be a truss with 40 lights going up, you know. And we had a track trail load of PA and stuff. And, you know, it was just, that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. But it sounded great, you know. Our thing was, I like using smoke machines and filling the whole bar. And we do that all the time. People loved that because they felt they were part of our show, you know. Mm-hmm. But, we tried doing that in a video a couple of weeks ago, and it looked like we were, I don't know what it looked like, but it didn't come across the way we wanted, so we didn't really push it, but, you know, but those are good tricks back in the days, you know, and we had a good time, but I'm glad to be a part of it. The young people today don't realize, you know, I've had questions the last interview, do you all rehearse? My God, I would never, none of my bands would ever leave if we didn't know the songs inside and out, especially if we're doing originals. You know, occasionally we would do cover songs, but we do them our way. Like we did Can't Always Give What You Want, but we did it our way. It sounded like, you know, and people were shocked to hear stuff. Like I tried to do B songs that you wouldn't hear, like Dancing Days. We'd play that and people were like, oh, I never thought to hear that. You know, that's what, if we do something, we're going to do it really good. But no matter what, we're going to be well rehearsed. And I do give credit to all my singers. Since I've been singing my songs, you have to know what you're doing, you know. And it's hard because we've had some singers that have some hard that audition that just couldn't do it. But now I understand, just like my bass, the other bass player is with me 14 years, never said a word, but he actually wrote bass lines for 200 songs. And now Kevin's doing the same thing, and he's not asking me questions either. They're just doing it, which is a big, you know, you don't until you get there and you go, oh, my God, you know, I really appreciate what these guys are doing.
One thing that I've heard and used in theater quite a bit, and I'm sure it definitely does apply to music, they say just don't rehearse until you get it right. Rehearse until you can't get it wrong.
And we'll rehearse without the vocalists just so we know the song inside and out.
Yeah, I would never bring the vocal in when we learned a new song because he'd be sitting there, him and Han and stuff. We'd learn it, and then we'd bring him in, and then bam. So, yeah, I forgot, Jerry. We still do that pretty much today, you know. And we don't use headphones 90% of the time in the studio. We play live like the good old days. We enjoy doing that. We have got a really good built studio, so it's not a lot of bleed over, but that's – we'd much rather do that. Of course, we do some overdubs and stuff. But as a general rule, we'll get down to three of us and lay tracks, you know. Right. And we can get them pretty well, you know. And it's the best way to do it. They don't do that too much anymore. It's cut and paste. But I don't use Pro Tools. We don't use it all. My stuff is equal to 2-inch tape machine sound-wise and stuff. And we just, you know, I have a 40-channel mixer, which I had an interview years back. Young guy goes, I went to John's studio. There's no computer. It's something called a mixer. And he had no clue how you recorded in the old days. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, we're analog to digital and old school, but it sounds really great. I don't know if you get a chance to hear some of our stuff, but, you know, so we do things the classic way.
Right. My wife is also an actor. She does a lot of voiceover. She's done everything from some radio commercials, voiceovers, behind, in other words, they'll do a commercial. I think she did one for a retirement community where they were just showing, you know, shots of the building and what it looks like in the building. And she was more like, it was more or less like narrating.
Right.
I was recording something one time and she went with me. We were talking in the studio because I was recording some voice and I was talking to the engineer and where I was saying, you know, you remember back in the days when editing was done with a razor blade?
Oh my God.
We were telling my wife about that, you know, how, I said, you know, back in those days it was done with a razor blade and, you know, you had to get it right at the right spot and
edit it. And when I used to own a studio called Rugby Road Studios with Paul Wolf, who owned API, all the expensive mix consoles. And we did a lot of voiceovers. I actually did a special with Oliver North and G. Gordon Liddy's daughter, a surprise thing for G. Gordon, who just passed away.
Yeah, I heard that.
So we did all kinds of stuff from that to, you know, a lot of commercials and voiceover stuff. So I enjoy doing that. I've done it myself as well. Sometimes people don't show up. I just go ahead and do the narration for them, you know. I've been approached by quite a few voiceover people looking for work. You know, I had a couple offers to do stuff for this company in California, but they want an ISDN line, and Warrington just don't have ISDN line. But they want to record in my studio and have me just send it right through the phone line to them live. You know what I mean? That would have been a great deal. But, you know, the ISDN line, I don't know if they even use those anymore. At Nissan, that was a big deal for all the radio stations. But, voiceover, you know, it's there.
Once you can get in, you could do very well. It's just hard to have the right thing, you know, hard to have the right voice for it. But once you do, you got it, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Have you seen any of the movie production in Baltimore picking back up because of the virus, or is it still pretty much?
Not much. You know, the area that I'm hearing is the real hotbed lately has been Atlanta. Atlanta has just been on fire. you know, a number of the guests that I've had recently are talking about moving from New York to Atlanta just because it's so big down there now. With all of the movies and, you know, Maryland, from what I understand, was not as welcoming to filming. I guess kind of after The Wire stopped, it would be nice if that came back because there are plenty of good people around here that would work. But everything that I've done nationally has come out of New York. You know, I go up there for auditions quite a bit. You know, I just hop on the train and head into New York City and then audition. But nowadays, once more productions start up, I think they're going to continue with auditioning from home, which is what I've been doing for the past year.
one thing I can tell you, a big change we've seen with the virus thing is when we did videos, it'd be at a on location, 6 to 8 camera angles. And one time we didn't do 8 and we had somebody remind us we didn't do 8. You know, people pick up on it. But now we just do one. We just said, let's do one camera, put it up there. And just a lot of people are doing the Zoom, like with multiple cameras. We just set up down there one camera and just play. And it's gone over really well. It's easier for us. But I think the people really accepted it quite a bit, don't you think?
Yeah.
We've had great response. You know, I love doing the big multiple, you know, angle things too. But this way we put out probably 10 right now that would normally take us months to do on location. But so we're having a good time with that. So that's a nice change. And it for people that don't have a lot of money, they can be able to pull it off a little better, you know, than what we had to do in the past.
Right.
And we're keeping busy with it.
Yeah, and we're keeping busy. But we're also putting out songs that we already had. Like the song we're doing tonight is called Thunder. It's been out for a while. The person in the UK from the record label picked it and said this song could be a hit in the BBC. So we're sitting there, go, what song do you want to do? Let's do Thunder. You know, it's not a song we go do a big production. Let's play Thunder because it's gone over. Because one thing people don't realize, I hope they wrote, in Europe, rock, 80s rock is still, American rock is still big time.
Oh, it is.
It's only here. It's only here that it's, you know, I've been calling and go, your songs are Germany. They're playing your songs every day. That's the kind of music they like, you know. And most of the rock bands are going to the UK and getting signed. And because it's easier than over here, because over here they're into the rap and all that stuff. Big, big money, big production. They want you to play across the country 10 times. You know, you go to the Europe, if you're a good rock band, you know, boom, you know. And so that's why we got a lot of good airplay, and that's what I'm listening to over there.
Oh, you're right about that. I went and saw it. The last concert I saw before quarantine was UFO, and I saw them at Ram's Head in Annapolis. And whenever they play here, they do Ram's Head, and they do some of Baltimore Soundstage. Same thing with Saxon, too. I see them here. But when they go to Europe, they're playing stadiums.
Yep.
And they're still huge, you know, at their age. And even though, you know, they've been out forever, that stuff never went away over there. Here, you know, people, there's still an audience for it here. Obviously, you know, they kind of come over and do like the summer tours or like the classic tours where maybe Saxon, UFO and Blue Oyster Cult would play together.
Right.
And do those. But when they go back over to Europe, I mean, my God, they're playing, you know, festivals and stadiums and they're packing them. And that's their, I guess they still come here to maintain a presence and everything. And, you know, there is a demand for it, you know.
The guy over in the UK, he offered us a real nice deal. But he says, if you can get one of your songs in the top 50, and then he said, maybe the top 25 in the BBC, you'll be invited to every festival in Europe, you know, all the rock festivals. All you have to do is place it. And which we felt song, he thought the song Thunder would do it. But then it came into some other things that I didn't agree with. Nothing really bad. No one's trying to rip us off or anything. It just wasn't feasible at that point. But that's how it can be. If you can place it on the charts over there, they'll at least invite you. You might play at 11 in the morning. You know what I mean? I used to do all the Lollapaloozas. And at Shenandoah Downs, a band went on 11, a band called Green Day. No one ever heard from them. So 11 a.m. is not bad sometimes, you know? But so, you know, that stuff's out there. It's possible. But that's really good to know. We just sold CDs to Toulouse, France.
Nice.
We saw them all over the place, but we got fan clubs in South America and I think Italy or Greece. It's kind of crazy. So
it is.
We've been around a long time, but we haven't really done like a full tour thing since 99 or something like that. They've followed us, you know, and like I said, we got websites, we got Facebook. Facebook, we get like 40,000 hits a week. No, 20,000 hits from 43 countries a week. Now, nice. Are they all buying a CD? No, they're not buying a CD, but they do click on us and it makes a difference to the labels and stuff, you know, but we get a printout. We're old school. We've been on Facebook so long. We still get the logistics thing and they'll show us the cities. I have one company go, there's your tour dates. It lists the cities, the countries, you know, and so we do get a lot of things out there. Do we make a lot of money off of it? No. Mm-hmm. But we do have exposure, so it's a lot of fun to see people enjoying our stuff. That's what we're at right now, pretty much.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
That's great. That's wonderful. One thing I like to ask my guests, and this is kind of a little fun thing. Have you guys ever had any Spinal Tap moments on stage?
Well, we had, on the major part of my tours, we had a singer that would stop the show to have a spotlight put on a girl or something. You never knew what he was going to do. And that's, it actually made us better musicians because we never knew if, you know, I used to teach my, that's why we rehearse about a singer. Because if he doesn't come in on the right time, we know we just got to keep up. He'll catch up with it. You know what I mean? But other than him surprising us with some stuff, really not, nothing that's out of crazy, you know.
The games on stage.
Oh, yeah. We'd, in the early days, we'd pick a person in the band. Like we were at, if we were at a club that loved us, the owners loved us, like there was a place called 11th Frame in Martinsburg. Wilbur and his dad owned that place. We could do no wrong there. And so we'd be there like Wednesday through Saturday and Wednesdays and stuff. We could have a good time. And so that'd be a part of our show. For instance, the guitar player would have a solo. Then he would do like a little Chuck Berry lick and we'd come back on. And this one night he did it and he looked over and we were shaking our head. Nope. And we did that to him like 10 minutes. Then our singer from Mercury Smash started throwing 45 records from the DJ booth at him, you know. So we'd pick or we'd say on a certain song, we'd catch the bass player at the fastest part and we'll stop and go blah, blah, blah on bass and walk off stage. And he'd be like going as fast as he could, you know, a few little tricks. But that's when you've been on tour for a while. You know, and you're really not screwing each other up, but you're playing little games, you know. Or one place we'd go, no matter what side the bass player's on, everybody go to the opposite side of stage. So slowly we'd go to the right. Then he'd look over, he'd be by himself, then he'd move over, then we'd all, no matter where he was, we'd get away from him. And I don't know what the people in the audience never said anything, but it had to be funny, you know.
Right.
We're all together, 4 hours on this, 3 hours on this side, and then no, three on the right, and he's by himself. So stuff like that, you know.
That's wonderful.
We were just basically having fun. We weren't, you know. I tell you, the Spinal Tap that we had at the 11th Frame, the stage was built in front of a door. The door to outside was halfway closed. Stage covered. And I remember the guitar player telling the bass player, move your case, move your case. And, oh, it's okay. And then that night of the show, I heard something. And we looked, and the bass player fell through that half door.
Oh,
right in the middle of a song. So that's about the worst of it.
I fell off the back of a drum riser once.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Got a big applause.
You know, a place was notorious for that was CBGB's. I'd played up there and there were like loose spots on the stage and the back of the drum riser was very dangerous. I know a number of people took a spill off of that one, too.
Did you ever play the Stardust down in Waldorf?
No, no.
That place had a million pieces of duct tape on that stage. It was,
God.
That was a crazy place. But that was an interesting place. We always had a good time. Because, you know, the people that used to play on there was like Peggy Lee and all those Vegas people back in the 50s. And, you know, the Mafia was there. And but that place had just the whole stage was duct tape. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, CBGB's had the the notorious bathroom there. They had they even put a movie out about that with Alan Rickman starring as playing the part of Hilly Crystal, and the catchphrase for the movie was CBGB's 50,000 bands and one disgusting bathroom, because they never washed that bathroom.
That's called Louis Rock City.
Yes, it was.
We had one of Louis. I remember Johnny Winter signed the shower. It was like, mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Yeah. Didn't want to use those bathrooms.
No. There was another one I think I went to where, I think they never cleaned the bathroom. People had, leaked everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it actually started to rot through. The wood had actually rotted through where you could see down into the basement. Yeah, it was pretty nuts here. So, guys, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. Yeah, it was really enjoyable to listen to your stories and, have you come on and, talk.
Mention our websites, and we'd appreciate it.
Sure. Well, that is what we're going to do right now, because this is called shameless plug time. And you can shamelessly plug anything that you would want to plug as shamelessly as you want to, with no shamelessness spared. So go for it, guys.
Okay. Well, our regular website is augustrockband.com. Okay. WWW, of course. Then if you want to hear our publishing song, which is all kinds of styles, it's augustmusicgroup.com. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Then the studio is dreamtrackstudio.com. If you want to check out our studio. Eventually, it will be open to the public again. But right now, it's just we'll figure it out as we go until things get better. And then, of course, we're on Facebook, August Rock Band, Facebook. We're on Reverb Nation, August Rock Band. Mm-hmm. And YouTube, big time. If y'all can go to YouTube and subscribe, it's August Rock Band on there as well.
Okay. Well, wonderful. Well, thank you again so much for being with us. I've really enjoyed getting to know you and talk to you and everything. And come back at any time.
Please. I appreciate it, Mike. Please come back at any time. So. Yeah. And that Wentworth commercial comes back, let us know.
Oh, boy. I'll tell you what, if you watch daytime TV, it's on there quite a bit. The daytime TV, it's on ID Discovery quite a bit. And it's also one of the channels that have those shows that have to do with a judge.
Yeah, like I know what you're talking about.
Like the People's Court type of shows during the day. It's on a lot of those. And then every once in a while, it shows up on Monday Night Football, too.
That's good.
So, well, great. Well, thanks again, fellas. And thank you all for listening. You've been listening to August on Foul Players Radio. And we'll see you next time.